Find out what's on in our city on ORFM's Dunedin Community Notice Board. Go to oar.org.nz and look for the link. You're one click away from up-to-date community event listings, and you can post your own notices free of charge.
This programme was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here today. He is back in Dunedin, though, but we'll get him into the studio real soon. And me, Samuel Mann. Each week we talk with somebody who's making a positive difference and try to find out what motivates them, what keeps them involved in this great, good work. Tonight I'm joined by Aileth Grant, who, amongst other things, is a volunteer at Orokanui. And edits or produces the Wild Ways reports in the Otago Daily Times. But she didn't start out as that. She's done lots of other things. She is a retired lecturer from Otago University in
German.
Let's go back a bit further than that, though. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dunedin.
What sort of life was it growing up?
A very simple middle-class life without much time spent outdoors. I was thinking about that today, how different it is for primary school children. You know, they go out into the outdoors, they learn about the bush and the creatures that need protecting and so on. We had none of that. And in those days, our parents' generation were too busy, you know, growing vegetables in the garden to feed the family. You had an occasional Sunday drive in the car, but really not much outdoor life at all.
Did that growing vegetables stick with you?
Yes, it has. Not until I owned my own house, mind you. I think my father despaired I'd ever get interested in a garden. And then once I owned a house, I found myself discussing every spade turn with him.
You're still doing it?
Yes.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Always wanted to be a teacher.
Why is that?
Well, my mother was one, and her stories about teaching made it sound a pretty enjoyable life, and she didn't really want to give it up and get married, but she did.
So you went off to teachers' college?
No, I went to university on a studentship, as it was in those days, which gave you an income while studying, but different from these days. And so I got my degree and then went to Teachers College. But I was lucky enough to get a scholarship, so I had a couple of years in Germany before actually hitting the classroom.
Why Germany?
Well, I'd done a degree in German, had a master's in German, and, there were scholarships available.
Okay, so why German?
Well, I had, at high school in those days, if you went into the academic stream, you automatically did French and Latin, and I was good at both and loved them. And at Queen's, which was my school, in the sixth form you could pick up German, which I did. And then I just carried on with my school subjects right through university and happened to do best in German.
And you eventually carried on teaching German.
Yeah, I taught high school German, and after about 4 years in that, decided it was time to go back and see my friends in Germany. And so I had another couple of years there teaching English. And then, this will be unbelievable in your ears, out of the blue got offered a job at Otago University without applying for one.
That's not what they're doing now.
No.
So you were teaching German at university?
At university for 30 years.
Mm. Wow. Mm. There have been a lot of students go through there.
Yeah. Our classes were never huge. First-year post-high school class was generally somewhere between 30 and 40 students. And when we introduced beginner's courses, later stage, we got up to numbers like 70. But that dropped off again as more languages were introduced. There was so Japanese, then Chinese, and then Spanish was the big hit for a while. And now all languages are really under pressure, along with all the rest of humanities. So I'm quite glad I'm not there anymore.
Why would you... Well, sorry, I suppose the question is, would you advise somebody to do a language at
any time? Most of our students combined their interest in languages, because quite a lot of our students had already been in Germany on a school exchange program and fallen in love with the language and the place and wanted to keep that up, but they wanted what the Germans would call a Brotberuf, a job that's going to earn you an income as well. So they would combine it with often law or commerce, or simply do a double major in arts in something that they could be fairly sure they'd get a job with. And, you know, that's a very broadening experience. Take our Minister of Health. He's got a degree in German as well as one in theology. I think that's the great benefit of humanities degrees. It broadens people.
He's got a PhD in German, hasn't he?
He's got, no, in theology.
Of a German philosopher.
Yes, yes. So he doesn't seem to have suffered by it. And, you know, it amazes me. You know, given that the relatively small size of the German department as it was then, where I hear the names of those students recurring in society, they're contributing in a big way. Yeah.
But it's hard to justify if you're looking at it from that, where's the jobs pathway?
Well, I always used to argue with them that if you do a major in something else, and it might be, you know, something like law or commerce, but you have the foreign language as well, you have a skill that other people don't have. Lots of our students, as a consequence, went into foreign affairs, that sort of thing, but also into business. There were plenty of people who were very much in favour of students who had a humanities background as well as something else. It's that flexibility, thinking laterally. It used to astonish me what students, what ideas they had about where they were going to go, not just with their language but with all their other skills as well. So it's never a disadvantage, it's always a plus.
So you've been retired for
11 years now.
And now you're heavily involved in volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
Had you always been involved in community things, or was it you retired and I said, now what am I going to do? What was the process there?
Well, while I was, you know, teaching at the university, I'm afraid it's pretty much a full-time job, although you seem to manage to find time for other things. But I always went tramping in my summer holidays. I took that up. Learned to walk in Germany, really. I discovered my legs went as well as anybody else's. And so I got into that when I came back. And I loved that. So when retirement was coming up, a couple of years before I had planned to retire, I visited a friend in Auckland who was heavily involved with Tiritiri Matangi, and I spent 4 days with her on the island and seeing things like kōkako hopping along the ground in front of me. I just absolutely fell in love with that project, and that was just at the stage where Orukanui, or the ONHT, had already got established. They had the plans for Orukanui, they were busy fundraising. And so by the time I came back from that Auckland trip, I knew what I was going to do in 2 years' time. And the fence was completed almost to the day I retired. So it was a very smooth transition for me. And it felt like this was my opportunity to give back to what I'd always loved doing.
It's an interesting thing that the fence was such a massive project, but it really was just the beginning of the work.
Yes, yes. And having been there involved ever since, I've seen it evolve, and you watch the plants grow, and you start to rejoice when you realise the plants along that track no longer need weeding, they're looking after themselves.
So what was it that you came back to Orokanui with this is what I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, as I said, it felt to me like my opportunity to give back to the natural world, if you like, to the bush, which I had loved all those years. But it was also an opportunity to learn a lot. Perhaps because of my background in teaching, I got asked to do things like organise a series of talks and workshops and so on. So I got to know a whole lot of colleagues at the university I hadn't known before in botany and zoology and so on, and sat in the workshops and listened to the talks, and I learnt from them. And then I got involved in guiding there too, and our chief guide, just about everything I know about Orokanui, I learned from her. And I developed an interest in things like what are the trees and the plants and so on, as well as all the birds and animals and participating in the reintroduction of these things, and going along and having to feed the tuatara in the pen and clean out their dishes and weigh them and measure them and so on. All of that sort of thing gets very exciting, this hands-on stuff I just loved. And, of course, the other huge benefit is you meet a whole new circle of friends who are doing the same thing and share the same passions.
How many people are involved?
Well, there's not many paid staff, only half a dozen of them. All the rest, and there'd be, I'd say, 100 or more volunteers who are regularly involved, and more than that who are sometimes involved, occasionally.
And how's it arranged? Is it some sort of hierarchy?
No, you can't have a hierarchy in that sort of organisation where you've got, you know, 1,000 hours of volunteer labour going into it on a monthly basis. And, of course, it's the paid staff, the conservation manager and the rangers who organise the work. And for a long time, we had a good 10 years, one person who was organising the group that was doing the planting and the weeding. That was Valerie Fay. She was an amazing person. And because you need team leaders too who facilitate the social aspect of it, because most people there are, like me, are retired. But every now and again we get groups of students from Polytech, for instance, who come in and do a day's work or a day's learning, the people who learn to tree fell and things like that. There's been lots of planting and weeding done by the ecology students. So all of that takes a lot of organisation, and the paid staff don't have the time to do it all. So volunteers are pretty crucial. And there are a number of, I would call them, teams. So there are people who turn up on a regular basis once a week or twice a week for a whole day. The men tend to do that. So on a Wednesday, which is my day out there, there's an amazing group of men who've done a lot of the infrastructure building and do a lot of the pest monitoring, because you have to keep checking on the presence or preferably absence of rats and mice and stoats, and that has to be done on a regular basis. So once people have done a job a few times, they know what's what. And so the conservation manager can say, well, we have to do mouse control today, and off they go with the equipment, and they know the tracks that they're likely to do. There's about 150 kilometres of tracks in that sanctuary there that have got tracking tunnels every 50 metres, and the tracks are 50 metres apart. So, you know, it's all GPS. It's very well organised and has developed.
You talked about the passion. Mm-hmm. Is the reward intrinsic?
Sorry?
Is the reward from just from doing it, or is there some kind of, you know, how do we make sure that people are actually enjoying it enough that they come back next mm-hmm. Wednesday?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the social aspect of it. I know so many more people in Dunedin than I ever used to when working at the university, which is a big enough employer. And those people, the motivation of those people were much the same as mine was. They like to be outdoors in the open air. They want to be doing something towards supporting the wildlife, supporting the natural life generally, I think.
Are there jobs that people don't want to do?
Oh, there are jobs that
there must be the equivalent of shoveling out the toilets or something.
Yeah, I cleaned the toilet yesterday, actually. I don't like it much personally when it gets all festooned with cobwebs, so I go and do something about it.
But it can't all be feeding the tuatara.
No, it's not. The pest monitoring can be pretty physically exhausting. The tracks are very up and down. I got to the stage where I had to tell Elton, our conservation manager, look, that particular area, that's getting beyond me physically.
Right.
So you can give me easier tracks to do. But at the moment, I seem to have a pretty cushy life because I put out the sugar water, which takes, you know, a couple of hours in the morning, feeding the birds, and then it's time to feed the takahe, and there'll be a collection of visitors waiting for that moment because the takahe know to be there at 11 o'clock because that's when their supplementary food will be put out. So then I tell all the visitors, the story of our takahe, and that's getting to be quite a long story now. There are some jobs. For instance, I think the probably the least favoured one of the rangers themselves is cleaning lichen off the hood on the fence, because you have to do it on a wet day because that's when it comes off easiest. It's nearly 9 kilometres around, and
some of it's really steep.
Yeah, and the water then runs down your arm. Not a nice job.
What's the long-term future for Orokonui?
That's a very big question. One would hope that it will continue, and I think one of the biggest, not exactly a problem, but one of the most important things to happen is recruiting new volunteers, younger volunteers, because we all are 10 years older than we were when we started. And that's why the educational side of the program is vitally important. And that's where I think the sustainability aspect comes in. We have an excellent education program. Most people know Tahu McKenzie by now. And she has from preschoolers who are already learning how to plant, how to weed, how to look after the new trees that are being put in. They learn about all aspects of the wildlife at Orokonui. And it goes right through to high school students, to programs that are linked in with their NCEA curricula, and then on to university students, who zoology students in particular, who are doing their own projects for master's degrees and PhD degrees out there. Now, all of those young people right through are getting what I lacked in my childhood, that involvement with the outdoors, the learning what it takes to look after this beautiful world we live in New Zealand. And therefore, I would hope that that whole idea of looking after the kaitiaki aspect of what we do would just simply become part of their inner being, really. And when they've got the time, when they retire, perhaps it takes that long, they will get involved too. But in the meantime, be doing an awful lot more with their children in the wild in a knowledgeable sort of way than my parents could with me.
How do we engage people not just in the I don't know how you describe it, the hero birds, perhaps? How do you get people from the colourful flappy things, not very colourful, the flappy things, and get them to look at the smaller things, the lichens and the mosses, yeah, and so on?
I think it's when you begin to understand that it's a whole ecosystem that we're trying to look after, and that's what Orokinui really is about. It isn't just a zoo. We have to tell people all the time, because you can't promise that they're going to see this, that, or the next thing, although you can pretty much guarantee.
If you come at takahe, feeding time, you can.
If you come at feeding time for the takahe, you can. If you come on a sunny day, you can pretty much be assured of seeing otago skinks. But we can't point out to them where they might find a jeweled gecko, because those geckos have to be protected from being poached, because we know that has been happening on the peninsula in particular. So we have to be very careful about what we do. We have what we call advocacy animals. That's a dock word. So there are a couple of tuatara there that for about 7 months of the year will display themselves by sunning in on a nice day. But then for 5 months they just virtually, you know, stay in their burrows and don't come out at all. But they are just the representatives of somewhere between 80 and 100 tuatara who are out there running around and hopefully breeding. And Alison Cree, Professor Alison Cree's students know more about them than anybody else.
How much is the ecosystem managed? It clearly requires active removal of the pests. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, at least, feeding of the tui and so on.
That's largely for the sake of the visitors. Initially, when the kaka were introduced, they were the first translocation to the sanctuary, and you couldn't be sure that there was enough natural food in our regenerating forest, it's not original forest, to feed them. And so the feeding stations were set up to ensure that there was sufficient nourishment for them. So with both sugar water and those days that we were giving them a mixture of nuts and seeds. But the tui and the bellbirds are invited to participate in the sugar water as well. And that, of course, pretty much guarantees that there will be birds to be seen for visitors who are walking along past those feeding stations. So they serve a double purpose. Now, you note that in the winter, yes, there's a lot more birds, particularly tui and bellbirds, around the feeding stations. And the kaka are sort of creatures of habit too. They like to socialise, and they don't seem to need the feed as much, but they're just there. They know when you're going to come around with it, and you can start imitating their calls, and a couple more will fly in, and often there's 7 or 8 kaka in the bushes when I take the sugar water out in the morning. And these days. Most other times of day, you can be pretty sure to encounter a couple of kaka somewhere near a feeding station. Whether or not they need any food, they might be just hopping around in the trees, doing acrobatics, picking away at the bark, as they do in the wild.
Do we know how far they are spreading in the rest of the day? Because they're not fenced in, are they?
No, there's nothing to keep them there. They've been seen in Warrington and on the peninsula. People who live in the settlements close by, like Osborne, if they are people who put out food for the birds anyway, we've had reports as there's one family in Osborne who will get five or six kaka there at once at their own place. And then they come back. But the thing is, Orokanui has the bush. It has the place where you want to build a nest. But we want them to go out beyond. And, of course, with the newest projects, with the Orokanui halo, so the trapping that's going on outside the fence now and ever further, so the people who live in Waitati and Purakanui and Port Chalmers and so on, they're getting involved in trapping on their own properties, and that's being managed by a different trust altogether, and being very well organised. So the vision is eventually all of that area right into possibly the Silver Peaks might well be pretty safe for birds to nest in.
And that would have the benefit of keeping them away from the fence.
Yeah, well, yes, keeping the rats and mice away from the fence. Yes, we would hope so, and stoats in particular, the ones that we're particularly concerned about.
A family of stoats decimated our chickens at Sawyer's Bay.
Oh, right. Well, they decimated our saddlebacks.
Yes. But we're seeing more tui and bellbirds in particular over the last couple of years. I've no idea whether that
Whereabouts
is.
Whereabouts do you live?
At Sawyer's Bay.
Right.
We've no idea if they're sort of coming down the hill or if it's a bigger population building up, but it's certainly encouraging.
Yes. Well, one of the jobs that I was also given to do was, because I don't mind talking to people, you know, groups of people, I've done quite a lot of talks to garden clubs around Dunedin and so on. Initially, it was really important because people didn't even know where Orokanui really was. If they were as old as me, they knew about the Orokanui Hospital. You know, I worked there as a student. But they weren't sure, so we had to get them there. And now Dunedin people are really good about doing return visits and bringing their own visitors to Orokanui and so on. And so I don't have to do as many talks anymore because it's well known already.
To what extent does that protecting the ecosystem, as you described it, to what extent does it rely on it becoming a tourist destination?
That's something we talk about a lot. When the cruise ships first started coming to Dunedin in some numbers, we thought, oh, this will be what saves us, you know, will bring us in an enormous income. And it doesn't. We worked very hard at trying to get into the program of the cruise ships. We were told it will take 3 years before you can really be in that program. But it's never come to much. The people from cruise ships are ones who've organised a trip themselves via local tour guides simply because they're interested in birds and wildlife. When the groups come, and interestingly enough, the groups that do come are German groups. Germans love wildlife, and it's where I get a chance to do the guiding in German for once because we can now. We have sufficient people who have foreign languages that we can offer tours in the language required. German groups will come in numbers, but they're the only ones. Part of the problem with the cruise ships is that at most they've got an hour to spare, and that's really not enough to get much from a place like Orokonui. So they prefer to put them on a bus and take them out onto the peninsula where there are penguins and seals and sea lions and albatrosses, all within a relatively short space, and people don't have to walk far. Yeah, that's not the answer. You get camper vans, but I guess the biggest attraction, the biggest moneymaker is the one that's coming up next month, and that's Sirocco. He's back. And he really is a huge draw card. And people come from far away, from overseas, to see Sirocco. So the bookings are already quite heavy, I'm told.
It's a very charismatic megafauna.
Yeah, he is.
But you've managed to put together a visitor experience. It's a nice cafe. Yeah,
it is a nice cafe, yes.
It's a nice cafe with a nice view.
Mm.
And there is a... You can do the short walk into
yes,
it.
Yes, I mean
it's a nice experience.
We're fortunate in that the upper 17 hectares, I think it is, actually belongs to the Otago Natural History Trust. So we've been able to put structures on that land, which we can't do in the dock bush, of course. So it's allowed us to build a visitor centre, to have an enclosure for the Otago skinks, for the Tuatara, and at that open area, the grassy area, which is just fine for the Takahe. And that, along with the relatively short, the easy walk, if you like, most people can do and get enjoyment from, because they do encounter the birds and sometimes lizards that they hope to see. Yeah. But they can also, if they want a guided walk for a bit longer, where we can take more time just to stop and watch and listen for birds, we can offer that too. And the real bird lovers from abroad generally want to do that, and so you go and we know where we can find a robin to show them, and you could take them sort of deeper into the bush, and you can talk more at length about what makes our bush really, and what's important for the different sorts of birds and so on.
Do you think that there is a dedicated eco sanctuary tourist market of people travelling the world looking at eco sanctuaries? I know you've been around the ones in New Zealand, for example.
Quite a number of them. Mm.
Is there a circuit? Are all those things on a single brochure?
No, I don't think so. No, because they're all individual projects. They're not, although there is an overall organisation now. So Colin Campbell-Hunt, our present chairman of the ONHT, he was instrumental in setting up a nationwide organisation. And I think Elton Smith, our conservation manager, has just been at a meeting of those groups so that they can exchange experience and knowledge for the individual projects. And of course, a place like Tiritiri Matangi has been so successful that they're able to offer birds for translocation to other sanctuaries. And so there's plenty of communication between the sanctuaries, but they are individual and each has its own character, is what we've learnt. And so Rotokare, for example, in Taranaki, it's a completely different sort of forest from ours, and it's got a lake in the base of it. It's like the inside of a volcano, really. But that lake has always been open to the general public, so they have to have a vehicle gates that people are allowed to drive through with their boats. So there's a different sort of problems, of course, in terms of pest monitoring and so on.
That must be a nightmare.
The risks involved.
Getting rough,
well,
mice
it's
through
working
that
very beautifully. And there's a couple of sanctuaries that work that way. So there are all different recipes, but it'll always be, there's probably, I mean, there's a new one now up by Nelson, Whether there'll be any more in the South Island is probably unlikely, because the fence building side of it is extremely expensive. And if you've got to renew that fence, say every 30 years, we were told this one would last, that's a lot more money. It'll be more expensive by then. I mean, the hope would be, of course, that by then we don't need one, because Dunedin's predator free.
Can we go to that not needing a fence? Can we scale up by not having the fence?
That's what we'd hope in the long run, and the optimists would say, yes, it's doable. Remember, Paul Callaghan was the one who first suggested that it really might be possible to think of a predator-free New Zealand. Most of us have a fair degree of scepticism, but if you can keep the predators, the pests, really down to low numbers, then I'm not sure that we'd really ever have kiwi wandering around our backyards in Dunedin, but we might have kaka flying around much more. I mean, the other day during the science festival, I went down to the observatory, and as I was walking home late at night, heard a moorpawk calling just nearby. And that's a couple of times. Last winter I heard one. So I think the environment generally in Dunedin is improving, and the amount of planting that's going on of native trees is amazing, you know, and that's what's going to help the birds as much as anything.
The elephant in the room, or perhaps in the forest, would have to be cats.
Well, I don't see that. Yes, feral cats, yes. But the family moggy, I don't see as a real issue. As I see it, cats generally hunt at night. Birds generally sleep at night. Cats are looking for mammals at night. So rats and mice, we want them to catch those. I haven't heard of cats actually climbing trees at night to get to the branches on which birds are perched. As I see cats as hunters, they react to movement. And if a bird's perched on a branch asleep, it's not moving, it's not catching the cat's eyes. So I'm sceptical about the need to keep cats indoors. That idea came to us from Australia, where they have lots of little marsupials there that are out at night that they're trying to protect. It's a whole different problem in Australia from here. Mm. So I don't, you know, I would be in favour of there being no more than one or at most two cats per household, preferably just one. But dogs are really a bigger issue for kiwi in particular. Though most of the kiwi deaths are from dogs. So,
and that's a real dissonance for people, isn't it? That they want to be protecting. Mm. They want to you know, see the ecosystems return to what we once had, mm. or at least have some sort of vision of what we once had. But we also want to have our cats and dogs.
Yeah. I live alone, and until a month ago, I had a cat, and home's never felt like home without a cat in it. And sadly, this one got ill. But I'll probably have another cat, but only one.
I hear you're going to the Galapagos.
I've been there.
You've been? Mm. What was it like?
That was a couple of years ago. Mm. That was wonderful, and it was everything that I hoped for, but it didn't mean as much to me as the trip to the subantarctic islands that I had a year or so before that, where I felt at home because it was still our bush and our creatures, really, whether it be sea lions that we already know from here, and go to Sandy Bay and see what's the major breeding place for the New Zealand sea lion. But the plant life was different. The mega herbs and so on was just amazing. But we, the trip I was on, we did full day walks there too, and it was just wonderful. It was our environment, but just that much further away, and therefore with the special character that those islands have.
Are you going to keep doing this?
Well, I am about to go overseas. But going to the United States, the only thing that would get me to the United States at the moment is their national parks. So I'm going to be having about 3 weeks walking in national parks over there.
Which ones?
We start with Yosemite and go to Zion and Bryce Canyon, the Arches, Mesa Verde, Grand Canyon, of course.
Arches is my favourite.
Is it? Mm-hmm. Oh well.
Make sure you get to the top ones and do the uh-huh. the big the slightly longer yeah. walks at the top.
Yeah. Well, it's an organised tour, and it is organised that we always have a full day wherever we are, which means you can do the longer walks. I just hope the temperature falls a little bit before we get there. Don't perform as well at 40 degrees.
They'll hopefully get you up early in the morning because there's yeah. stunning light in those places.
Yes.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I don't. I mean, only the dictionary meaning of the word. What it means for us individually is very different, I think. It's what we can do ourselves to the overall thing. Whether it be getting involved, as I've done, in some sort of specific project aimed at trying to restore our environment to something better than it has become. But I think that what I was talking about before, I mean, I've been a teacher all so many years, that it's going to depend a lot on education from childhood onwards through to the adults who perhaps didn't know about it earlier on, like me, so that it's an ongoing thing that we take it for granted that we have to look after our environment. And as part of the education, I think we need to become more politically aware. I think we fail our own society in not doing enough at school level to become good citizens, to understand what it is to be a voting person, member of a community, and informing ourselves of what the issues are for our own community and for the world. But I'm sane enough to know that that's a very difficult project, but you can be successful. Again, that was something that I found in my own teaching life, having spent time living in Germany. They're a much more educated democracy than we are, because they had to learn the hard way. And I think German school children are much more aware of international and national and environmental issues. My students who came back from an exchange program at a German high school had always turned into greenies. And before we were doing anything about recycling, they would come back and say, "Why aren't we recycling?" So that sort of engagement, that going out into the world and learning how other societies do it, is part of that process.
What's the German for sustainability?
Oh, don't know. That's a recent word. I haven't been living in Germany and not reading.
Do they use? I mean, they have a Green Party, don't they?
Yes. Yeah.
I shall look that up.
Yeah. So Umwelt is the environment. So Umweltschutz was the term that was the current term when I was living there. The protection of the environment. But they invent words as they need them.
Join a few together.
Yeah.
How does, like, I'm thinking again, you mentioned Tahu
McKenzie. Mm.
Who does a stunning job. Mm-hmm. How's that paid for?
Because we have funding from the ministry, the LEOTC, the Learning Experiences Outside the Classroom. So her salary is essentially funded by that, and she can employ usually university students who are doing zoology or botany or whatever, or environmental studies, to help her. So she has a whole team around her.
And she certainly has the knack of getting into the newspaper.
Yes.
So it's that education beyond just the kids that are sitting in front
of
you.
Oh, she's also involved in the project in Northeast Valley. Because a lot of the schools can't actually afford a bus to send their kids out to Orokinui, so she started actually doing things in town, so using the botanical gardens or I'm not sure what other sites she's got, so that the lower decile schools who couldn't afford to hire a bus could nevertheless have their children exposed to that sort of learning experience.
Perhaps we need to fence off a bit of the town belt.
Yes, well, the town belt, of course, is a very mixed bit of forest. There's an awful lot of exotic trees in it as well as native trees. But, yeah, why not? Get it looked after. I mean, the number of possums and the like in the town belt is an issue. But there are people who are now doing that sort of thing, trapping in the town belt, looking after the town belt. And that's the amazing thing, that there are groups of people throughout the country now. I don't know if you know the book Paradise Saved, which came out a few years ago, which covers about 300 of such projects, but there are about 1,000 of them that are listed there. And you can go for a tramp in the forest and you'll see, you know, the friends of such and such are looking after this part of the track. I think that it is spreading.
I'm in two minds about it. I'm too, like, why are we relying on volunteers to do this that's so important? But also, isn't it good that they're doing it?
Yes, that's right. Well, we do now have a government that is a bit more interested in putting money into it, not just they're actually walking the talk, I think, whereas we had the talk before. I think that the Department of Conservation, for instance, is getting to the point where they actually can get back to the job that they were supposed to be doing instead of just building toilets for tourists. I think we were in a terrible situation before where they were doing less and less of the real conservation work. They were becoming an offshoot of the Department of Tourism, which isn't what they were supposed to be. Sorry, that's my personal opinion.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
You mean at Orokinui?
Anywhere you like.
Oh. Don't really think of that, but, really just seeing the ongoing progress of Orokinui. Going to the annual general meeting recently and hearing that financially we're in a better position than we've ever been before. In my terms, the success is the thing as a whole rather than a personal success.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. So what's your superpower? What is it that you're bringing to the good team?
The willingness to talk about it, I think, as much as anything. You indicated you were interested in knowing how people's earlier skills related to what they're doing now. Well, I guess it is that background in teaching and communicating, as well as the willingness to be involved physically in things. I was brought up to be a reasonably practical person. So I enjoy that combination, I think.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Not really, no. I, you know, in my mature years have joined marches and do join marches on the street, but I don't have a long history of that, no.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Life's still interesting. I feel extraordinarily fortunate that I've got sufficient income that I don't have to worry about that. I've got good health that I can go out and go tramping every week, work at Orokonui every week, and do all the things that interest me. Belong to book groups, a choir, and so on. That to have the time to do what keeps me interested in life and still learning stuff.
And what's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to?
Haven't set myself specific goals, but to keep doing what I'm doing. To stay fit, really, when I'm 72, to stay fit, to be able to do, still go tramping and still work at Orokonui is pretty important.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
I think in the wider scale of things, it'd be to get rid of plastic. I get angry every time I go to buy something at Mitre 10 and everything's in tight little hard plastic packaging. And while it's lovely to think that we can do something ourselves about getting rid of plastic, single-use plastic bags, I think the plastic issue is a huge one. And it's how do you persuade manufacturers to stop packaging like that? I mean, I can remember when you went to the hardware store and they would weigh out some screws for you or count out some screws for you. But that doesn't happen anymore because they want to hang everything on hooks. And so that means more and more and more and more packaging.
They don't have empathy either for the environment or the users.
No.
You need a chainsaw to get into them.
That's right. Yes, yes.
Last question then. Do you have any advice for our listeners?
Get out there and do whatever you can in whatever small way. Something that makes you feel good about yourself and about the world you live in. Volunteering, it's not just about the environment. There are so many volunteer organisations in this city doing amazing things. And they're the ones then who, I mean, what you get from volunteering is enormous. That sense of self, of self-worth, of that life is still worth living. There's something other than the television in the corner of the room.
That's inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining me.
All right.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lands Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight we've been talking with Aileth Grant about volunteering, particularly at Orokonui, and wider about education, and finishing with some inspiring advice about getting out there and doing stuff, contributing. That was Sustainable Lands. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Find out what's on in our city on ORFM's Dunedin Community Notice Board. Go to oar.org.nz and look for the link. You're one click away from up-to-date community event listings, and you can post your own notices free of charge.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.